So I was going to do like a Morgan Freeman narrator voice here, but I just don't feel like that would pan out. So we're just going to do it normal. 106 miles, 30,000 stairs, 17,000 vertical feet climbed to an elevation of 13,550 feet or 4,130 meters. The Annapurna Base Camp Trek is one of the most insane adventures that you'll ever take. It's epic from start to finish, absolutely insane. One stat that I did not add here, 0 showers in 10 days. Absolutely filthy. One of the craziest things that you'll ever do in your life. So let's get into it. And welcome back to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me here again today. If you've been listening for the past couple of weeks, you would know that I just finished up my little series where I covered my Southeast Asia backpacking trip. But I really wanted to come back today and just really dive into the details of one of the most intense things that I did in this trip. And that was my 10-day trek through the Nepalese Himalayas to Annapurna Base Camp. Now, Annapurna Base Camp is one of the many treks that you can do in the Himalayas and is definitely one of the most popular. I would say that there are probably 4 main treks that people do while they're in Nepal and things that they can do in the Himalayas. I would definitely say that the number one trek, the most popular, would be the Everest Base Camp trek. I was actually originally planning on doing this trek. But I went late in the season. I was actually the very last trek that my tour group was taking. And because of that, the weather was really poor. And so I was not able to catch a flight to Lukla, which is sort of the home base for the Everest Base Camp trek. It's actually one of the most dangerous airports in the world. And so if there's any sort of bad weather or anything like that, they cancel all the flights. So I sat in the airport for 2 full days, and they were just continuously canceling all the flights, pushing them back. And I did give myself a window while I was in Nepal because I knew that would be an issue. But ultimately, I ran out of time, and my guide was like, hey, if we're going to get a trek in, we're going to have to go ahead and change up the plan and go ahead and get moving. So after 2 full days sitting in the airport, we decided to do the Annapurna Base Camp trek. And although I was really looking forward to doing the Everest Base Camp trek, Annapurna was amazing in and of itself. So I'm definitely glad that I didn't try and sit in the airport for a few more days and possibly waste that opportunity. So besides Everest Base Camp, a couple other ones, they all have to do with Annapurna. Annapurna is the 10th largest or 10th tallest mountain in the world. And so there's a trek called the Annapurna Circuit. I'm not exactly sure how long the Annapurna Circuit takes. I'm assuming it really just depends on you personally, but I believe it's over 10 days. I think it might be a 2-week at least long trek. It's pretty epic. There are elevations along that trek that are higher than Annapurna Base Camp. I believe there might be elevations higher than Everest Base Camp. There are some really tall portions, and so every once in a while, you'd see helicopters flying overhead, and they'd be going to that really high portion of the circuit, and people would be having to be evacuated because of altitude sickness. So that's definitely an epic trail. A lot of the people who I talked to who did that trek in particular did it on their own. They would just do it without a guide or anything like that. I'm not really sure why that was so popular for that set of trails. I don't know if it's sort of easier to follow and navigate on your own. For me, when I did the Annapurna Base Camp, I definitely recommend taking a guide unless you do that sort of thing a lot. But yeah, the circuit was something that a lot of people were just doing individually. So if that's something you're interested in. And then also is the next, I don't know if I would say it's the most popular trek, but one thing that I met a lot of people doing was the Poon Hill Trek. And this is actually part of the Annapurna Base Camp trek. It's just the first couple of days you walk to Gorapani, and there's a hill there called Poon Hill, and it offers great views of the Annapurnas of Machu Picchu. And it's a beautiful view. I mean, one of the best views I've ever seen. And so a lot of people will just simply trek up to that viewpoint and then turn around and go back home. But if you're on the Annapurna base camp trek, you just keep on walking after you get to Gorapani. So I would definitely say that those are the four most popular treks that I ran across during my time there. And rightly so. I mean, I can't really speak in terms of Everest. I think just based off of the research I've done and the pictures and things like that that I've seen, Everest is really rocky and just really epic and adventurous. And you're really doing that for sort of the glory of saying that you've been to Everest Base Camp. I know personally, I was really excited just to say that I'd been to Everest Base Camp. That was really cool and something that I wanted to be able to, you know, say that I had done. But as far as views go, most of the time, I believe there's only like one place on the entire trail that you can see Mount Everest. And all the trails, I mean, there's some epic swinging bridges and things like that. Namche Bazaar is pretty epic. The viewpoints there are pretty cool just over the city or the little town. But all in all, I feel like it's more just rocky and you're there for the trek and just to say that you've done that trek in particular. I was talking to locals who were on sort of the trail with me, and they were saying that Annapurna Base Camp trek was definitely the most... the sights were better. And so even though you weren't necessarily getting to say that, you know, you went to the base camp of the tallest mountain in the world, the views and the Himalayas that you are walking through, those mountains around that trek were definitely the best. And so obviously I didn't do Everest, so I can't, you know, compare the two. But Annapurna Base Camp, you were hiking through fields and valleys, and there were just epic viewpoints everywhere you looked. So I can't really argue with that statement. I definitely can't complain about switching over to that trek. So definitely, if you're looking for more of just enjoying nature and epic viewpoints, Annapurna, I believe, would probably be best for you. But if you're just sort of into the hype and you want to go to Everest Base Camp just to do it, then obviously Everest Base Camp would be the way to go. But all in all, I did go in June, the end of June. That's the end of the season, and so that's the beginning of rainy season, and so I did have to miss out because of weather, so just keep that in mind for whatever you are planning. Okay, so I'm kind of just going to break this down into the different days. It was a 10-day long trek, and there's two ways to get to Annapurna Base Camp. There's a more scenic route. And then there's a more direct route that's a couple days shorter. And so most of the treks will follow this same sort of pattern. There were only a few other groups, tour groups, that I met along the way. And we all kind of stuck together the whole time. Sometimes they would stay like a little town past us or the town before us. But for the most part, we kind of just stayed together there. And that was one of the coolest parts about this trek was simply whenever I first got there, I met with my tour guide, and I signed up for a trek that was going to have up to 12 people in it. But since it was so late in the season, I was literally the only person in this trek. So it was me, my tour guide, and I had someone carrying my bag, my porter. And so I was a little disappointed at first because I was on this entire backpacking trip solo, and this was the one time where I was like, okay, I'm going to have, you know, other people on this trek with me, and we're going to be able to just have a good time and, you know, just have a good time playing games in tea houses and just talking and visiting. It's just going to be awesome. So I was a little disappointed at first, but I quickly got over that for multiple different reasons. First off, my guide was awesome. I'm sure most of the guides there are pretty cool, but my guide was really neat. We, you know, had great conversations and, you know, just became great friends along this trek. And then also, because I was the only one on this trek, it was really just my pace. You know, I didn't have to wait on, you know, 10 other people to decide if they needed to take a break, if they were tired and needed a rest, if they were hungry, if they needed to go to the bathroom. It was just me and my guide. So, you know, if we're walking and it's been like an hour and he's like, hey, let's take a water break. It's like, okay, we stop, take a water break, and we're good to go. There were multiple times where we were like with a group and one of them would have to stop to take a break. And they would be sitting there for like 15, 20 minutes waiting for everyone to feel ready to go. And we were, you know, a mile down the trail already. So just having that, you know, freedom, I guess it's really just one of the best parts about solo travel in general, really applied here as well. You didn't have to worry about these 9 other people or 11 other people with you. It was just you, your guide. And because of that, I was able to complete the trek, not a shorter amount of days, but shorter amount of hours each day. I was able to complete about 2/3 of the timing. So let's say that my porter said, oh, this is going to take 6 hours today. You know, I could get it done in like 4 hours. And that's simply because there weren't 10 other people there that we had to worry about. So I really, you know, started to enjoy it the farther we got along, and I saw the benefits of being by myself. And there were, you know, you were constantly passing other groups of people. You could talk with them on your way up. You would stay at tea houses where there were, you know, multiple groups staying as well. So, you know, it wasn't as bad as I was thinking it might be. And I did end up, you know, meeting several groups of people that were really cool, made some good bonds there on the trek. And, you know, I think I had the best of both worlds there. So let's go ahead and get started. More than likely, you're going to start, you know, in Tommel. That's where, you know, most people stay, or in Kathmandu somewhere. And so the first day, we went from Tommel to Pokhara. And we took a little tiny flight, and this was probably the scariest flight of my entire trip. It was this little, I believe it was a 2-seat by 1-seat plane, and there was like 10 rows, and it was like a little propeller plane. And when we flew into Pokhara, we were like flying less than 10 feet above all these buildings and houses, and we were going in so fast, and I thought for sure we were going to crash, but it was pretty epic. The cool thing about flying there in Nepal is the Himalayas are so massive. You would be looking at your plane and you would just see these like white dots and you're like, oh, look, those are clouds. But no, they're peaks of mountains coming above the clouds. So it's pretty epic. Everywhere you look, there are just massive mountains. And so it's really cool. So you land in Pokhara, and Pokhara is called the gateway to the Himalayas. It's an amazing little town. And a lot of people just go to Pokhara because of the views there, and they might spend a day or two in Pokhara while they're in Nepal. So I believe I mentioned that in my Nepal portion of my backpacking trip series, just to visit there in general. But you start off in Pokhara. We spent the night in Pokhara, and then we went ahead and we took a car from Pokhara to Nayapul. And then from Nayapul, we hiked to Tikidunga. So Nayapul is where the drivers, all the taxi drivers from Pokhara will drop you off. And this was a crazy drive. I do not get car sick whatsoever, but this ride was so bumpy, so windy. You were gaining so much elevation. I thought for sure I was going to throw up in the back of this car. It was the worst drive ever. I mean, the views were amazing, but it was just such a miserable drive, winding around these mountains, up and down, all around. It was pretty crazy. So if you have like motion sickness or something, you might want to take some medicine before that part of the trip. But it was definitely a crazy drive. And they drop you off in Nayapul. And then you go ahead and you start hiking. And we hiked all the way to Tikidunga. Now, in Nayapul, you can get, that's where you get all of your, like, passes and your permits and stuff to trek. And this is a pretty easy day of hiking. I think we hiked maybe 2 or 3 hours, and it was mainly through fields, grassy, like, rice fields, things like that, and some valleys. There was very little elevation gain hiking-wise, and it was just a great sort of day to just get out, stretch your legs. You're super pumped up because you're starting this trek, maybe a little nervous, but it's a great hike, an easy day, and we quickly made our way to our first tea house of the trip. So the second day, we hiked from Tikidunga to Uluri, and then from Uluri to Gorapani. Now, this is my self-proclaimed hardest day of the trek. And there's actually two hardest days, and I'll kind of explain how they're different. I'm saying that this is the ultimate hardest day in terms of what you have to do. And I'm simply saying that because this day kicked my butt. And it was only the second day of the trek, which means I was fresh, I was excited, you know, I was pumped up, and this was still difficult. Later on in the trek, like day 7 or 8, there's another very hard day. But by then, you've been hiking for like a week straight. You know, you've been eating like rice and vegetables, and you're just kind of worn down. And so a hard day then, I don't feel like is necessarily as difficult as a hard day now. Mentally, it's just as hard. But here, physically, I feel like this is obviously the hardest day if it's already kicking your butt day 2. So the reason it's so difficult is because the elevation change is enormous. As soon as you leave Tiki Dunga, you have to climb 3,500 steps straight up a mountain. And I mean, you're just climbing steps for like an hour and a half straight. And it is absolutely miserable. And the whole way you're walking up these steps, there's just these little kids running up and down the stairs, going to and from school, from, you know, their friends' houses or whatever. And you're like, these guys are like 12 years old and are in way better shape than I could ever be, simply because they're climbing up all these steps every single day in this altitude. But the best part of this day is once you climb to the top of these 3,500 steps, you get your first glimpses of Annapurna South and of Machu Picchu. Machu Picchu is one of the most recognizable mountains in the area. It's called Fishtail Mountains because it has this little fishtail looking V sort of notch cut out on the top peak. And it's actually the holy mountain of that region of the Himalayas. And so there's actually never been someone who has officially summited Machu Picchu because of that reason. I believe a few years ago, someone like worked out a deal with the government and they were able to climb within like 100 meters of the summit. But officially no one has ever summited that mountain, which is pretty interesting. So this day, after those 3,500 steps, you've really climbed out of the fields and into the mountains. And so from here on out, you just have epic views, you know, everywhere you look. There's huge mountains everywhere, and it's just absolutely beautiful. This is going to be the first day that you cross a swinging bridge. It wasn't a huge swinging bridge, but it was still one of those, like, they have a wire running from one side of the mountain to the other side, and there's, like, these planks that you walk across, and it's swinging over, like, a raging river. So it's pretty epic. And it's, you know, it's a difficult day, but it's a great day, and it gets you really to where you want to be. Now, like I mentioned earlier, Gorupani is where Poon Hill is at. And so a lot of people, this is sort of the last stop of their trek. They'll go to Poon Hill, and then they'll turn around and go back home. For everybody else, you just keep on going. And I'll also mention that for some reason, from really all the way up to, like, Yuleri, there were cars driving up and down this road. And so the whole time I'm just getting passed by 4x4s and I'm like, I've been climbing stairs for the past 2 hours and we could have just taken a car. And at first you're like, what the heck? Like, I'd much rather be in that car. But climbing from, you know, from Nyapul up into that point is just part of the process and part of the experience that, you know, you would definitely miss out on if you took a car. I'm not sure if cars go all the way up to Gorupani, but they do go quite a ways. You could really skip that whole first day and take a car if you really wanted to. So day number 3, you start off going to Poon Hill. So you wake up in Gorupani. I think we woke up around like 4 in the morning, climbed Poon Hill. It's another like 1,000 steps to the top of this mountain, but you know, you're basically just, your legs are so dead you can't feel anything at this point, so it doesn't really matter anymore. But Poon Hill is an amazing viewpoint. You can see all the Annapurnas, you can see Machu Picchu, and the views were so great up there. I looked at my guide and I was like, are these views going to get any better at base camp? Because if the views are not going to be any better and I walk another 5 days for nothing, then I'd rather just like turn around right now. And he was like, no, the views are definitely way better at base camp. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'll keep walking. And they definitely were. But the views at Poon Hill were amazing. So after Poon Hill, you go back down to Gorupani. I think I maybe took a nap, packed up, had breakfast. And then we took off to Tatapani. Now, this leg of the trip is where you really get into the up and down elevation change. And for me, this was kind of frustrating because, you would spend so long climbing a mountain, and then the next thing you know is you're climbing down this mountain. And so every time you climb down, you know you're going to have to climb back up to, you know, regain that elevation that you just lost. So that's something that happened, you know, along this entire trek, was just constantly you would be on one mountain and you'd look across at the other mountain. You're like, okay, that's where I'm going. But there's not a bridge or anything, so you have to climb all the way down the mountain to the valley and then all the way back up the other mountain to basically eye level where you were just before. So it's kind of frustrating, but, you know, it's just something that you gotta live with and come to terms with, that you're going to be, you know, going downhill a lot, and then you're just going to have to regain it all, you know, within the next hour or two. Now, like I said, a lot of people will sort of turn around after Poon Hill, and so because of this, the crowds will start to thin out. I mean, being the end of the trekking season, there weren't a ton of people on the trek, but you could definitely tell that after Poon Hill, there were only like two or three other trekking groups with me. And so it definitely started to open up. There was one group from the UK that we would constantly pass back and forth. And then I met up with some Australians later on. And that was about it. So not too many people on the trail once you pass Gorupani. But I'm sure, you know, in high season, that's totally different. So a crazy thing that happened on this leg of the trip is some of the trails are kind of narrow, and you can be like on the edge of a cliff, and then there's like a wall face right next to you as well. And so one day, you know, they're constantly taking donkeys up and down these mountains, taking food and supplies up and down to the different little towns up there. And so we're walking, and all of a sudden we hear these bells that are on the donkeys, and they're like, we can tell that these donkeys are just stampeding down the hill. And so we're like, there's a cliff over here to the right, and there's a straight up cliff face over here on the left. And we're like, we don't know where to go. And so literally, as we see like a herd of donkeys rounding the corner, just barreling down at us, me, my guide, and my porter, we just jump up on the wall and like grab some tree branches and hang on as these donkeys just stampede past. And then their driver, like the herd guy, just runs past them with his little switch, like yelling and screaming at them in Nepalese, trying to make sure that none of them fall off the cliff or anything like that. So you always have to be, you know, watching out. That happened a couple times where things like that would happen. And so, you know, just adds to the excitement. This day was not too difficult. Climbing up Poon Hill was probably the hardest part, but all in all, not too difficult of a day. Day number four, you go from around Tatapani to Chamrong. Chamrong is awesome. It's right on the edge of this epic valley, and there's just amazing viewpoints of Machu Picchu and all the Himalayas up and down this valley. It was really cool. The place I stayed at had sort of like the dining area of the tea house was just totally encapsulated in glass, and so I would just sit there and watch the sunset, watch the sunrise, and it was absolutely amazing. Now, it's really funny because a lot of times there's these dogs who live in the towns, and they'll kind of just, like, follow you all over. And so from Tatapani to Chamrong is the first time that we actually, like, had a dog follow us the entire time. And so this dog, like, as we were leaving Tatapani, he just started following us, and he literally followed us to Chamrong. He spent the night sitting outside my door, and then the next morning, he followed us from Chamrong up to Dovan about halfway before he finally, like, turned around and started walking back home. And so you'll just randomly pick up these dogs that'll just follow you, and it's pretty funny. One thing about that that happened on this leg of the trip was there are often, just like there are mules and stuff on the trail, there's also like bulls and cows and things like that. And so this portion of the trip, we were walking, this dog had been following us for quite a while, and we get up to a part on the path, it's another really narrow piece of the path, and there's this bull standing there like right on the edge of the path, and then there's a calf standing next to it. And so my porter, he's just like, we're all kind of just standing there like, do we want to cross paths with this bull? Like, this thing is enormous. So my porter just kind of like sprints through and makes it to the other side of the bulls. And so it's me and my guide on this side of the bull. And then my porter is just standing on the other side, kind of like dancing around, like excited that he made it past. So all of a sudden, my guide's like, okay, I'm going to sprint. And then once I get over there, then you sprint too. So I'm like, okay. So he sprints through, he makes it, no big deal. Well, this dog is behind us, and all of a sudden he decides that he's going to like try and, you know, growl towards this bull. So he walks up to the bull and he starts like barking and snarling at it. And this bull starts charging this dog, and the dog runs the opposite direction of me towards the porter and the guide. And this bull is just hot on its trail. And so we're on this little tiny trail, and all of a sudden there's this bull just stampeding towards this dog that in turn is running towards my guide and porter. And so they're just like trying to sprint away from this bull, and they like jump up again onto the side of the little cliff face there. And this bull kind of just like rushes off and like kind of pushes the dog down a little less steep part of the hill, the little cliff face. And so he kind of like rolls down maybe like 5 or 10 feet, and is just kind of like standing there watching the bull to make sure he doesn't charge anymore. And so then as soon as that happens, I'm like, crap. So I sprint as fast as I can to get up to my guide and porter, and then we kind of just take off. And then like probably 15 minutes later, here comes that dog just coming back following us again. And we're like, you need to quit causing trouble because you're going to get us hurt. So once again, it's pretty funny. There's a ton of random little things that just happen along the way. And so that was one of them. That was pretty hilarious. Okay, so in Chom Rong, it actually started to pour down rain. Like I said, this is the beginning of the rainy season. And so it started totally dumping water towards like 9, 10 o'clock that night. And it was raining all the way up until like noon the next day. So about noon, we're still sitting there because, I mean, it's just pouring cats and dogs. We can't go anywhere. And so about noon, it kind of starts to line up a little bit. And so my guide's like, all right, let's do this. Let's go. So I have on like waterproof pants. I have my boots on, obviously. I have like a rain jacket on and everything. And so we go ahead and take off. It's raining, but it's not, you know, raining too terribly hard. Well, we walk about 15 minutes, and we're pretty high up on this mountain, and we have to walk down the mountain to get to the other side. So we're going downhill, and the walkway, we're still in town, is kind of paved. It's like flagstone walkway. And I mean, all of a sudden it just starts raining, like pouring all over again. And this little trail has just turned into a roaring river. And so we kind of step into another tea house, and we're just standing there and we're watching, and we're like, there's no way that we can make our way down this trail. I mean, it is literally just roaring. So we're like, okay, let's go back to our tea house. So we walk through the water up, you know, 15, 20 minutes back to our tea house, go back, sit back down. About an hour or two later, about 1:30, 2 o'clock, it kind of stops raining again. So we're like, okay, let's try this again. So finally, we take off, and it sort of gets sunny a little bit. We get all the way to the valley between the two mountains, and it starts raining again. But we're like, we're already halfway to Dovin, so there's no point in turning around now. So we continue walking through the water, get completely drenched, but we finally make it. So day 5 is Chom Rong to Dovin, and it was not too difficult of a trek there. But simply all the rain, you know, made it, you know, more miserable than it needed to be. There are, once again, great views of Machu Picchu there. And because it was raining so much, there were some epic waterfalls in the mountains while we were hiking. They were still there when it wasn't raining, just not as pronounced. I mean, once it was raining, you could just see these waterfalls were just crazy epic. Okay, so day number 6. Dovan to Machu Picchu base camp. Obviously, you're in Machu Picchu base camp, so there's amazing views of Machu Picchu. And then you're also pretty close. We're a day away from Annapurna base camp, so you also have great views of Annapurna South. There are a couple different Annapurnas. There's Annapurna 1, there's Annapurna South, and then I think there's a third Annapurna at least. But Annapurna South and Annapurna 1 are the most recognizable ones there. Now, this is the second hardest day of the trek. And so, like I said, the first day was hard because, you know, I was fresh, I was ready to go, and it was still, you know, kicking my butt every step of the way. Day number 6, dove into Machu Picchu Base Camp. You had to climb 1,000 meters in elevation. And the last 2 hours of your trek, you climbed 500 meters of elevation. So because of that, you were, you know, climbing straight up. You'd been climbing for, you know, this was your sixth day. You were worn out, you were exhausted, you were tired, and you were still, you know, having to perform these pretty epic feats. So because of that, I'm not saying that this part of the trek was harder than day number two, but they're definitely both crazy difficult, just depending on, you know, how you look at it. But both of them are very difficult, and I was very excited to get to Machu Picchu base camp that day. So once again, there's amazing views, and in the Denali area, there are some awesome, like, glaciers. I call them glaciers. They're more just like icefall that was just like super thick and like football field size ice plateaus there. And there's some great valley views. So you're walking through a valley before you get to that 500 meters of elevation gain. And there's like sheep herders and there's like this little river that runs through the valley. It's absolutely beautiful. There's like watch out for avalanche signs throughout the valley because it's a high, like, high potential of, you know, having avalanches there during the winter months. It's just a really awesome place. One of my favorite places of the entire trek was that valley there around Denali. Now, those little glaciers or ice falls that I talked about, those are pretty sketchy. They're all pretty vertical, and you had to walk across them. And so, you know, this is where you'd see, like, people wearing crampons and things like that, but all I had was, like, my hiking poles. And so you would just like take, you had to walk really slow across this area. It was pretty sketchy because if you slipped, you would like slide down this entire mountain and then have to climb your way back up. I don't think it would necessarily have been dangerous to slide all the way down, but it was just like, you didn't want to have to put in any more work than you had to. Also, you'd be looking over to like the left over there and there was this huge waterfall coming down the cliffs. And into the ice, and the guide's like, oh yeah, all that water, there's this river that we're walking across right now. And he's like, I don't know how thick this ice is, but I mean, I guess it's thick enough to hold us. So, you know, you're also battling like, oh, any minute I could just fall through the ice into this roaring river. So that's great too. There were some crazy sketchy bridges along this portion of the trail too. I think I have one posted on my Instagram. If not, I'll have to throw that one in there because it's pretty sketchy. It's literally like two poles on sitting on these two rocks, and then there's like maybe three or four cross sections of this bridge, and it's not even level. Like, you would walk on it and it would like shift every step you took. It was pretty scary, not gonna lie, but made it across. One of the guys from the UK, they kind of caught up to us at this point, and one of them fell through. And so he was just like sitting there straddling some of the cross beams on this bridge. And like his bottom half was just completely soaked in this ice water. And I was like, that sucks. But he survived. He made it. So it's all good. Okay. So once again, day number six, dove into Machu Picchu base camp. Pretty difficult. But once you get to the base camp, I mean, it's epic. You're like an hour or two away from Annapurna base camp. The UK group there, they actually continued on to Annapurna Base Camp and spent the night there instead of Machu Picchu Base Camp. So once again, it kind of just depends on the group that you're with. I enjoyed staying at MBC, but you know, I'm sure staying at ABC would be pretty cool as well. So day number seven, Machu Picchu Base Camp to Annapurna Base Camp, and then we turn around and go back to Dovin. We once again got up really early, like 4 o'clock in the morning, headed up to Annapurna Base Camp. It's honestly one of the most epic views I've ever seen in my life. First off, you get to the Annapurna Base Camp sign. It's like, welcome all who enter. Like, congratulations on making it. It has like the elevation, all that kind of stuff. It's pretty cool. Take some cool pictures there. Make sure that you turn around at this point because there are some epic views of Machu Picchu behind you. But if you're not paying attention, you'll just totally miss it because you're walking away from it. So make sure you turn around, look over your shoulder every once in a while. You do walk across quite a bit more ice going up there, but it's pretty epic. And after you know, take pictures at the sign, all that kind of stuff, you head up into the actual base camp. And this place is a wreck. I mean, it absolutely gets destroyed like every other year by avalanches up in Annapurna. And so, I mean, it's like, it looks like a ghost town. And since we're, you know, I was there at the end of the season, it's pretty closed down. So, like, the people who stayed there just stayed in an abandoned building and, like, camped. So it was, like, completely closed down. And so it's pretty epic. There's some cool, you know, photo opportunities just because there's so many abandoned buildings there and things like that. But Annapurna 1, the 10th tallest mountain in the world, is just sitting there. It is huge. You know, all these mountains are enormous, but Annapurna 1 is just, like, magnificent. There's an actual glacier. It's called the East Annapurna Glacier. It just sits there right in front of Annapurna 1, and it looks totally out of this world. I mean, it's pretty epic looking. You think you're looking down at, like, a moon, like the moonscape or something like that. It's pretty crazy. So Annapurna Base Camp is totally crazy. I think I stayed maybe an hour and a half up there just, like, taking in the views. Definitely recommend just, like, sitting down and, you know, having, like, I think I had a Snickers bar or something, just, like, enjoying your time up there. I mean, you hiked 7 days to get there. Just take a few minutes, you know, enjoy your time taking the views before you turn around and leave. So after that, we headed back to Annapurna Base, or to Machu Picchu Base Camp, packed up, had breakfast, all that kind of stuff, and then headed back to Doven. So from here, we're kind of just backtracking for the next couple of days. Day number 8, we went from Doven to Chom Rong, and then day number 9 is where we start to split ways. So from Chom Rong to base camp, there's really only one route, but then to Chom Rong from, Jurali, there are multiple different ways to get there. Not Jurali, Naipaul. From Naipaul to Chom Rong, there are two different ways that you can get there. Okay, so from Chom Rong, then, on day number 9, we went to the Sialli Bazaar. And so, you know, if you've done any sort of research into these treks, I'm thinking of Namche's Bazaar, where it's a pretty epic little town. And it's a pretty cool place. There's a lot of shops, things like that. Well, that's why it's called a bazaar. If you think of a bazaar in, like, Middle Eastern terms, just, like, a ton of shops, just crazy colors, people yelling at you, everything like that. This was not like that at all. It was just like a couple little tea houses there, and I'm not really sure why it was called a bazaar. Maybe I just didn't see why. But it was just a little small town, pretty cool place. This was actually the first stop that I was able to eat meat again on this trek because of how long it takes food and stuff to be trekked into the tea houses and things like that. It's not advisable for you to eat any sort of meat products. And so along the way, we had really just been eating, like, rice and veggies and things like that. So this was the first time, because we're only, like, a day out from the end of the trek. My guy was like, hey, if you want to eat meat, you can. And so I think I had some chicken. It wasn't very good, but it was the first time I had had chicken in, like, over a week. So I didn't really care at the moment. So also the last part of this trek, you're also doing it on a paved road, which was amazing because after trekking through the woods and forests and mountains and everything, just walking on a flat surface, whether you're going up or down, it didn't really matter. It was just really nice and convenient. Basically all of day number 10, you were walking on a paved road as well, which was really great. The most epic part about day number 9 from Chom Rong to Sialli Bazaar was you crossed the craziest hanging bridge I've ever seen in my life. This thing was massive. On the way up, when we went to Chom Rong, you could actually see it in the distance. It was so big, and my guide was like, yeah, we're going to cross that in a couple days. And when we actually got there, I mean, this thing, you could see the people on the other side of the bridge, and they looked like little tiny stick figures. I mean, you could barely even see the people on the other side of the bridge. This thing was so long. It was crazy. You got about halfway across, and, like, it's so long, just any sort of momentum is going to make this thing swing back and forth. And so you're, like, in the middle, and you're just swaying back and forth, back and forth. It's kind of sketchy, and you're just over this massive river. But it's pretty cool. Definitely one of the coolest parts of that trek was crossing that huge hanging bridge there. So finally, day 10, we go from Sialli Bazaar to Naipaul, and then from Naipaul to Pokhara. Near Naipaul, there's this little city or little town called Biratani, and there's a bridge in Biratani. and it's really recognizable. It's like, I don't even know why it's recognizable, to tell you the truth, but it is. And so you cross it when you start the trek, and you can kind of see it off in the distance as you're coming back in to the Naipaul-Biratani area of the trek. And so I was probably like, you know, half a mile out, and I could see this bridge in the distance, and I was just like, praise the Lord, like, we are almost done. Like, I see this bridge. This is basically where we started. Like, we are almost done. So it was pretty epic sight. So keep in mind to look for the Biratani Bridge. And then, you know, probably this, besides the Annapurna Base Camp and those views, the second best view of this entire trip was walking into Naipaul and seeing just like 10 taxis just lined up waiting for hikers to finish the trek. I mean, I was probably like, you know, a quarter mile down the trail, and I just see all these taxis lined up, and I almost started crying. I was like, what a beautiful sight. Like, this is amazing. So yeah, that was my 10 days. It was totally epic, totally worthwhile. You know, as soon as I finished the trek, I was like, wow, this is something amazing that I've done, but I absolutely never want to do anything like this ever again. It was that grueling of a thing. Now, you know, I guess it's been almost 2 years, a year and a half later, I'm thinking, huh, maybe I could go back and do Everest Base Camp, you know, do that one since I didn't get to the last time. I'm sure I'd hate myself day number two. But, you know, after a while, kind of just sitting, thinking about it, mulling it over, it might not be that bad of a deal. But in the moment, as soon as you finish that trek, it's just like, wow, I just accomplished something crazy and I never want to try it again. At least that was my opinion. So a few things about this. I think it was about day number four. My knees were just absolutely killing me. There were so much up and down elevation gain, going down mountains, climbing back up mountains, that my knees were absolutely trashed after day four. And it was weird because it was going down. I guess that sort of stopping muscle was hurting. So going down hurt, but climbing up was not. So it was almost this weird thing where I was like looking forward to having to climb stairs because that was the only time my knees didn't hurt. And it was also pretty hilarious because my guide, I mean, he does this trek like 15 times a year. I mean, that's his job, is to do these treks. And so, you know, you just assume that he's going to be in really good shape. And so I would be kind of outpacing him on the climbing uphill. And, you know, I'd be at the top of the peak or whatever, and I have to wait for him to kind of catch up. But then going downhill, he'd be like half a mile ahead, and I'd just be like limping down the side of a mountain, like, I'm coming. Like, don't wait up, it's fine. So it was pretty funny. And so I mentioned already the food. You can't really eat meat for most of the trek. You could eat cheese, which I found interesting that you could have cheese but not meat. And so I would always have these cheese pizzas if I was kind of just like wanting something, you know, to kind of remind me of home and kind of just a comfort food, I guess, would be cheese pizza there on the trek. But one of the things, like, literally every guide and porter will eat dal bhat every single day. And dal bhat is just like this lentil soup and rice, and then you kind of mix it all together and eat it. And the one thing about dal bhat that is really the reason why they always eat it is because you get free refills. And so for everything else, like, oh, you ordered a pizza, okay, you get a pizza and that's it. But for dal bhat, you eat as much dal bhat as you want, and then, you know, you finish and they're like, do you want some more? And you can just keep eating as much dal bhat as possible, or as much as you want, for the same price. So, you know, I had dal bhat at the beginning, and then towards the middle, I was like, I just want like cheese pizza and just like plain rice because I wasn't necessarily feeling that well. But then towards the end, I was just like starving. I was like, just give me as much dal bhat as possible. And I would just eat that like every single meal. And it was really good. One thing I really loved about this trek, and you know, I'm sure this happens for any other trek, is just the camaraderie. Like I mentioned with the other people along the trek, even though I wasn't in a group with other people, there was a group from Australia that I stayed at a couple tea houses with, and we would just play card games all night. We would just kind of talk and tell stories, things like that. There was the UK group that they would always stay one town past where I was staying. And so like in the morning, I would hike faster than them. And so after about an hour and a half of trekking, I would pass their group. And while we were, you know, walking through their group, like we'd be talking, cracking jokes, whatever. And then we'd get to our tea house, and then maybe an hour or two later, they would walk through our camp, and they would go up to the next town. So then we'd talk some more. And so, you know, we'd only talk for like maybe a minute or two each day. But just because of that, like twice a day, you know, you'd wave at them, say hi, and everyone was happy to see everybody else. Like, oh, how are you doing? How was your trek today? It was just really cool. And then finally, I met this group. It was a husband and wife from Italy. And they spoke absolutely zero English. I mean, none whatsoever. And so, I mean, we couldn't communicate at all. But it was really cool because, you know, every time we saw each other, we'd wave, we'd say hi. And they finished a day before me because that last day when I stayed at the bazaar, you could actually take a vehicle, a car from the bazaar back to Niapol and then to Pokhara. And so a lot of people would do that. And so I showed back up in Pokhara that last day, and I go in to have dinner at my hotel, and they're just sitting down there eating, and we're like, whoa, no way, like, you're staying here too? And it was like this, you know, happy reunion. We hadn't, you know, spoken a single word to each other the entire trip, but, you know, we were able to kind of commiserate, you know, together of what we had been through and just how epic that trip was. So it was really cool. The guide that I had was amazing. I'm not sure, you know, if all guides are that cool. And I'm sure, you know, just being me and him and the porter made it a lot different as well. He didn't have, you know, 10 other people to take care of. But that was really awesome as well. If you want to know the guide service that I hired, feel free to drop me a line and I'll be happy to provide that information with you as well. One funny thing, just kind of wrap this up, is hills versus mountains. I mean, I'm from Arizona, and so, you know, I'm used to, you know, seeing mountains on a daily basis. And so, you know, once you get to the Himalayas, I mean, these mountains are enormous, like totally epic. And so our guide, you know, like every single thing that you see, I would consider as a mountain. And my guide's like, if it has like green trees on it all the way up to the top, we don't call it a mountain. We call it a hill. And so literally, I mean, these things are like thousands of meters tall. And he's just like, no, that's not even a mountain. That's just a hill, just because it has green all the way up to the top. So you know, it was pretty crazy. And that just shows you how epic the Himalayas are, where, you know, there are these huge mountains everywhere. But because there are so many tall mountains there, they have to just categorize them anymore. It's like, oh, no, that huge thing over there, that's not a mountain. That's just a little tiny hill. Like, don't even worry about it. So I guess one last thing that I'll mention real quick. Is altitude sickness. Altitude sickness is a big deal, and I'm not really sure if I had too many symptoms of altitude sickness. It really just occurs when you gain too much elevation too quickly, and they do a really good job if you're with a guide service where they trek you high, and then they have you stay the night a little bit lower elevation of what you had reached that day, and that's supposed to help. There were some times where I felt kind of sick to my stomach. I'm really not sure if that was altitude or if I was just, like, you know, exhausted from the trekking. I did, you know, have these packets that I put in my water, like electrolytes and things like that. I definitely recommend doing something like that because I drank so much water and was still dehydrated for the entire trip. I would drink like 3 or 4 liters of water a day. And it was still, you know, not enough, like in the 3 or 4 hours I was trekking. So definitely drink a lot of water. That helps with the altitude sickness. And then like electrolytes, things like that. I was climbing up into Machu Picchu base camp, and one of the Australians that I mentioned a few minutes ago, she was just completely lying out on like this little porch area of the tea house. And she had a towel laid over her face, and she was just like laying there, and she literally laid there for like 3 hours. And I was talking to the guy she was with, and we were just hanging out on the porch, like playing cards and stuff. And he was like, yeah, she hasn't moved in like 3 hours. Like, she feels terrible. And after, you know, about 3 or 4 hours, she got up and she's like, okay, I'm feeling a little bit better. She made it up to Annapurna Base Camp the next day. And then she was feeling better as they, you know, worked their way down elevation. I didn't see anyone have to get like airlifted. I did see helicopters flying to Annapurna Circuit to airlift people. But it is a real thing. But, you know, as long as you're drinking a lot of water and replenishing, like, your electrolytes and everything like that, I think you should be okay. The guides will take care of you and just make sure that you're working with them the whole way. So, with that being said, that was my 10-day trek in the Himalayas. You do have to pay for hot water if you want to take a shower. So I did not take a shower for 10 days. It was absolutely disgusting. I got back to my hotel. I took like a 30-minute shower as soon as I got there. Then I went out into Pokhara, bought some souvenirs, came back and took another shower just because it had been so long since I'd taken one. So it was pretty disgusting. There were a couple times where I would, I would literally sweat through my clothes every single day within the first like hour. Towards the end, you know, your clothes are soaked through, you're at such a high elevation that stuff does not dry. So you'd like take off your wet shirt, you'd hang it up to dry outside, you'd hang up your socks, all that kind of stuff. And then the next day you'd go out there and they're still damp. But since I was backpacking, I only had like 3 pairs of clothes. And so it's just like, I sleep in one, I'm trekking in one. So it was just like, do I want to get my sleep clothes all nasty, or do I just want to put on my dirty clothes and keep trekking? So I would just have to put on a nasty, sweaty, wet, cold t-shirt every morning and nasty, wet socks every morning and just continue my trek. All along, if you listen to my Indonesia podcast, I had these huge wounds on my feet from when I wrecked my motorbike, and so I'm having to wrap those up in gauze every day. It was pretty disgusting. But that shower when we got back to Pokhara was the best shower I've ever had in my life. It's the little things. So I just keep dragging on. But if you have any questions, comments, feel free to leave them here. Or on my Instagram at educateyourtravel, leave me a comment, send me a message there. I have pictures of my Nepal trek. I'll have to throw in a picture for that bridge that I talked about earlier, if I can find one. So check that out at educateyourtravel. Remember, it's up to you to make your life interesting. So get up, get out, explore the world, and take that next adventure. Thank you so much for listening here again today, and I cannot wait to catch up with you next time. Thank you.